I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. The country and the world were riveted by the emotional testimony yesterday by Christine Blasey Ford and Brett Kavanaugh. This afternoon, the Senate Judiciary Committee is expected to vote along party lines to recommend that Judge Kavanaugh be confirmed to be on the Supreme Court. A vote by the full Senate is expected Tuesday. With the court front of mind, today we explore one of its most far-reaching decisions. In 2013, it invalidated a key part of the Voting Rights Act, and since then, it's become more difficult for hundreds of thousands of people to fulfill this most cherished responsibility in our democracy. Dr. Carol Anderson has written a book about how efforts to restrict voting are premised in politics and race. It's called One Person, No Vote: How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy. Carol Anderson joins me right after the news. Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us today, and thanks to everybody who made a pledge and became members of WIPR during our fall membership drive. We all very much appreciate your interest in our work and your support. Today, a conversation about voting, not about who to vote for, but the act of voting itself. In a lot of places, and for a lot of people, registering to vote and the act of voting itself is hard. While there is consensus that democracy is best served when most people are engaged in the democratic process, there is much less agreement about how voting should be made both uncorrupted and easy for individual voters. An example, when Democratic Senator Doug Jones won his election in Alabama against Roy Moore last year, many credited his victory to the large turnout among African-American voters. But in her new book, Dr. Carol Anderson demonstrates that more than 100,000 Alabama voters can't vote because they don't have the ID required by the state. In fact, Alabama is one of the most difficult places to vote in all the land. And most of the people who are affected by strict voting regulations in Alabama and elsewhere are people of color. Carol Anderson is the author of a terrific book called White Rage: The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. Now she has turned her scholarly gaze to the often unspoken truths about voting. Her new book is called One Person, No Vote: How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy. Carol Anderson joins us on the line from Emory University in Atlanta. Carol, it's great to talk to you again.
Oh, it's great talking with you again too, Tom.
So the Supreme Court, of course, is front of mind today, given the extraordinary events of yesterday in the Senate Judiciary Committee. I've been listening to the proceedings of the committee this morning. They're preparing to vote on the Kavanaugh nomination this afternoon. So I want to use the Supreme Court as our sort of launching pad and the Voting Rights Act in particular. But just first of all, your take on yesterday's hearing, the testimony that we heard from Dr. Ford and Judge Kavanaugh, and where you think this is headed.
Yesterday was like the unveiling. What we saw was, on one hand, we saw a party that was doing its best to go by the rule of law and to have the structures in place to govern, which means that there's a process that you listen. On the other hand, we saw a party that wants to rule, and therefore laws be damned. And that was most clear. The whole process has been rigged, from not providing the bulk of his papers for review, from rushing this, from withholding witnesses, I mean, the whole nine yards. But yesterday, his anger, his rudeness, his hyper-partisanship, his sneering, when he said, when the senator from Minnesota asked, well, have you ever been blackout drunk? And he's like, well, have you? Now, if that had happened in a court of law, he would have been held in contempt. What we saw then was that, facts be damned, Dr. Ford was a very credible witness. He never answered the questions. It made it really clear that the goal to create an America where you've got a Supreme Court that will block progressive legislation, that will block democracy, and that will do its best to further gut voting rights, to gut reproductive rights, to gut women's rights, to gut environmental rights, to send us back to at least the 1920s. And some of this really feels to me like the Waits Court coming after Reconstruction that gutted the 14th and 15th Amendment. And it took us doggone near a century to get that back in place. And that's where... that's what they want to create. When they say make America great again, it is a process that they've put in place to try to strip the rights from the majority of Americans so that only this small, narrow band, it's almost like going back to the founding fathers, where you have to be white male propertied, a property owner in order to have rights. It is sick. It is disgusting, and that is why we must vote in November.
And of course, Mr. Trump ran on because he mentioned it constantly. He ran on in part his desire to put on the court conservative judges. So the last time that he appointed a judge, it was a conservative judge replacing another conservative judge, replacing Antonin Scalia. This is Judge Gorsuch. This time it's different because this judge is going to replace a man that people have considered a moderate, a swing vote, Justice Kennedy. If Brett Kavanaugh is confirmed, and right now it's likely that that will happen, the Judiciary Committee is going to vote, it appears, along party lines this afternoon to send the nomination to the floor. There's a procedural vote scheduled for tomorrow, and then a full vote in the Senate scheduled for next Tuesday. In terms of voting and voting rights, we've already had the decision by the current court back in 2013 that gutted a very important section of the Voting Rights Act. What's your expectation about what may happen in the area of voting in particular if Mr. Kavanaugh is confirmed?
I think it's going to get worse. Remember, he was the judge who found that South Carolina's voter ID law was constitutional. That voter ID law basically required government-issued photo ID, but only certain types of government-issued photo ID in order to vote. There was clear documentation that about 80,000 South Carolinians, primarily African Americans, did not have that kind of ID. And there was also evidence where a couple of South Carolina legislators were talking about it, and one legislator from South Carolina said, "Well, you know, if we gave black people $100, I bet they could find a photo ID. They'd be running like, I think it was like bees on watermelon." And the other legislator said, "Thanks for supporting voter ID." And Kavanaugh looked at that exchange among the South Carolinian legislators and said, that's not all of them. And so I don't see any kind of racial discrimination here. This is what we're going to see. And it's going to become solidified. So many of the states after John Roberts' court in that 5-4 decision, Shelby County v. Holder, gutted the Voting Rights Act in pre-clearance. And that means that states that had a demonstrated history of discriminating against their citizens' right to vote, had to get all of their changes approved for voting rights before by the Department of Justice before they could be implemented. After Shelby County was gutted, states just ran to the fore, just implementing one discriminatory measure after the next. And we know this because of the wave of federal court rulings, like in Texas, this is discriminatory, this is discriminatory, this is discriminatory. In North Carolina, this is discriminatory, this is discriminatory, this is discriminatory. It's going to get worse. Because evidence won't matter. Racial discrimination won't matter because what voter suppression is designed to do is to cull the electorate. It is to remove as many people from the electorate as possible. And this is part of Paul Weyrich, who is the head of ALEC, which is the organization that had designed a lot of these voter suppression laws that spread throughout state legislatures, and also one of the founders of the Heritage Foundation. He said, you know, I don't want everybody to vote. In fact, our leverage goes up as the voting population goes down.
Yeah, and it's really astonishing, and you remind us, for example, that in Texas, they passed a more restrictive voter ID law literally 2 hours after the Shelby County v. Holder decision came down. They were waiting in the wings. I mean, there were a number of legislatures that had legislation teed up, ready to go, depending on how that decision came down. So they acted quickly, and they acted in a variety of ways, and you elucidate how those ways, what those ways are. I want to talk a little bit about the election in Alabama. Doug Jones versus Roy Moore, and of course, it's a heavily Republican state. It's a real it's Trump country, to be sure. But Doug Jones was able to eke out a victory because so many people were able to be mobilized to vote. But you remind us how expensive it is to mobilize that many people. A whole lot of money was spent in the effort to get Mr. Jones elected.
Yes, absolutely, and you know, so in Alabama had deployed every method of voter suppression against its black population, those particularly in what are called the Black Belt counties, and that included voter ID laws that were very restrictive. It included shutting down the Department of Motor Vehicles in the Black Belt counties, and then only after pressure from the Obama administration towards the last, you know, few moments of the Obama administration, opening some of those up for like 1 day a month or 2 days a month. So really not open. It included massive voter roll purges where registered voters are removed off of the rolls shortly before an election. It included gerrymandering, which, although it doesn't sound like it would affect a statewide election, what gerrymandering does is it actually depresses the voter turnout because people begin to feel like the system is rigged and their vote doesn't count. And they also shut down 66 polling stations in Alabama after Shelby County v. Holder. So all of the methods had been deployed, and it still looked like Roy Moore was going to win. Roy Moore, who was one of the most unsavory characters to get close to the U.S. Senate in the 21st century. And it took the kind of grassroots mobilization from civil society, the NAACP, the ACLU, the League of Women Voters, Vote Riders, Black PAC, Black Voters Matter. They all were pouring in, working with people, talking to Alabamians about what was important to them and what were the consequences, getting people the IDs that they needed, actually getting people the documents that they needed in order to get the IDs, doing all of that work, getting people who had felony convictions registered to vote after Alabama finally identified what crimes made a felony made it possible for you to be disfranchised. They did all of that work, getting out the vote, but all of that takes money. It takes a lot of money to go door to door, to have organizers in place for months on end, knocking on doors, talking, and so millions of dollars poured in. Senate PAC alone poured in, I think, over $6 million, and several other PACs were pouring in money. But the brilliance of that strategy was that they didn't come in going, oh, we know how to do this. They trusted the people on the ground, the people who had been there for so long, who had worked with their neighbors, who knew their communities, who knew what the strengths were, who knew what the value systems were. And they trusted those local grassroots organizations to effectively deploy those resources, to deploy all of that money, in order to get out the vote. and to increase voter registration, and they did. It was a near run thing. I mean, let's be clear. It was a near run thing. Right now, we could have had, God forbid, Senator Roy Moore in the U.S. Senate with his antebellum ideas. But we don't, because black people mobilized and black women mobilized.
And we'll talk more about that when we come back from a quick break, and what that mobilization looked like in Alabama, what it can look like moving forward. And again, we're going to go through the ways that voters and voting has been suppressed, voter ID, purging things from the voter rules, from the voter rolls, making regulations onerous, making it really difficult to get the documents you need. We'll talk about all that with Dr. Carol Anderson. Her new book is called One Person, No Vote: How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy. When we come back, you are welcome to join our conversation at 410-662-8780. You can drop us an email, midday@wypr.org. You can drop us a tweet at @midday WYPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. By the way, coming up Monday on Midday, Investing in Baltimore. A group called Homecoming Baltimore, or Baltimore Homecoming, has invited prominent people from business and entertainment with local roots to come back to Baltimore and learn about opportunities to invest in various initiatives and companies. The hope is that their investments would create jobs and grow the local economy. I'll talk with the founders of Baltimore Homecoming, as well as Mary Miller. She's a former senior official at the U.S. Treasury, about her work with the 21st Century Cities Initiative, which includes tracking business capital made available to local companies by local banks. So that's coming up Monday here on Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you just joined us today, my guest is Carol Anderson, the chair of the African American Studies Department at Emory University in Atlanta. We're talking about her new book, One Person, No Vote: How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy. She joins us today on the line from Emory. She will be here in Baltimore tomorrow afternoon when she'll talk about her book at the Baltimore Book Festival. If you'd like to join us today, our phone number, 410-662-8780, our email, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @midday WYPR. If you want to follow me on Twitter, that'd be terrific. It's @TomHallWYPR. So, Carol, back to the Doug Jones and Roy Moore race and how much it cost. I think of this because there are three candidates, Democratic candidates for governor around the country now, any one of whom could become the first black governor in America. We've got Stacey Abrams in your state of Georgia. We've got Andrew Gillum in Florida. And here in Maryland, we have Ben Jealous. All three of them have said that a big part of their strategy is to get those voters to the polls who have heretofore been marginalized, who have been out of the political process, who have not chosen to vote in past elections. Because, as you say, there's this notion that everything is rigged and it's not going to do any good. But here in Maryland, Ben Jealous is working financially with considerably fewer resources than his Republican opponent, Larry Hogan, who's a very popular Republican governor in an overwhelmingly Democratic state. The last reports, you know, had the Hogan campaign with $8.5 million and the Jealous campaign with fewer than $400,000. So without the money, I mean, is a candidate like Ben Jealous going to be able to, in fact, mobilize everybody? Of course, Ben Jealous is an experienced community organizer. He's the former head of the NAACP. But, I mean, how do you handicap that race when it comes to, with the example of Alabama being, you know, fresh in mind, but when it comes to actually getting this mobilization together?
It's going to be tough. And one of the things, of course, that has made it even tougher has been the Supreme Court Citizens United decision that allowed, that basically said corporations are people. And
they're money,
and
too.
That,
yeah.
capping their financial contributions and saying who's giving, that violates their First Amendment rights. And so we got a wave of dark money pouring in. And so we don't even know who's contributing that money. But we know that there are strings attached, and so you get this kind of massive imbalance. And so I have defined this as like a two-pronged attack. I'll just put it this way. There are only, you know, for all of their money, there are only two Koch brothers. So they only have really two votes.
Mm-hmm.
And so having the rest of the people being able to vote, that begins to balance the Koch brothers. But when you have Citizens United that allows all of that dark money to flow in, and when you have massive voter suppression that pulls down the vote, particularly those who are repulsed by the policies that systematically deny people the right to vote, that are about denying reproductive rights, women's rights, equal pay, equal rights, environmental rights, criminal justice reform, access to quality health care, basic stuff, then what you have then with voter suppression on one hand and dark money flowing in on the other hand, you have a massive imbalance in the political democratic system.
And I want to talk a little bit about the race in Georgia. Stacey Abrams, mm-hmm. a member of the Georgia legislature, running against the Secretary of State, Brian Kemp, a Republican. Full disclosure, my mother lives in a suburb of Atlanta. She's in her mid-80s, and she is volunteering for the Stacey Abrams campaign and has been for a few months now, and will continue that through the election. But you say that Brian Kemp, the Secretary of State, has mastered the art of the purge. Let's talk about purging voter rolls and how that's worked in Georgia and other places.
Yeah, and so what purging, there's two ways that they do it. One is to keep people off of the voter rolls who are trying to register to vote. So I'm going to talk about that piece first, and then I'll talk about the purge itself, because it's just lethal. So Brian Kemp has a program called Exact Match. What Exact Match does is that when a would-be voter fills out the voter registration form, it goes through and they match it up to see whether all of the information is identical to the information that is in either the Department of Motor Vehicles database or the Social Security database. If there's one thing off, that registration is denied. And what that
and for
means,
example, that means, is, for example, your name is Carol, spelled
yes.
without an E at the end of it, right?
But if, that is correct.
If someone were if someone named Carol leaves the E off or adds the E when it's not there, that would disqualify her.
Exactly. Exactly. And this could easily happen because my middle initial is E.
Yeah.
So you could see how something as simple as a typographical error stops you from voting. Or if you have a hyphenated name, and so in one place you've got the hyphen and in another place that hyphen isn't there, and that particularly happens to those who are Hispanic. Garcia Marquez, right? And so you get this overrepresentation of minorities. So, for instance, in one wave of voter registration using Exact Match, African Americans were one third of the registrants.
Mm-hmm.
They were two thirds of those denied using Exact Match.
Yeah, and he's the Secretary of State, and he's the one who controls the electoral process. And now he's a candidate for governor himself. It's quite
yes.
an intricate web of stuff down there, isn't it?
Yes, it is. The way that the purges work, it's reminiscent of the Mississippi Plan of 1890, which was the rise of Jim Crow and the massive disfranchisement of black voters. What they did in Mississippi in 1890 was to say, we cannot say we don't want black people to vote because that violates the 15th Amendment. But what we're going to do is to use the societally imposed characteristics of African Americans and make that the litmus test. So we know that we have underfunded their schools, and so we're going to make literacy one of the tests to vote. We know that between hundreds of years of slavery and now sharecropping, we've got massive endemic poverty. So we're going to make the poll tax one of the tests to vote. Similarly, what happens in purges here in the 21st century is that they have used, the secretaries of state like Brian Kemp, have purged over 1 million voters off of the rolls. The majority, a large number of those voters have been purged simply because they haven't voted regularly. Now, the law was clear. The National Voter Registration Act, which we call the Motor Voter Law of 1993, was clear that you can't kick somebody off the rolls simply because they don't vote regularly.
Yeah, and so given the fact that Americans have a terrible record when it comes to percentages of the electorate who actually do vote. I mean,
exactly.
It's among Western democracies,
one of the lowest.
One of the lowest in the world. Yeah, absolutely.
Yes.
But still, just because you choose not to vote in 2008, 2012, and then you want to vote in 2016 or you want to vote in 2018, there are states like Ohio and other places that say, all right, if we haven't heard from you, we haven't seen you at the polls in the last couple of cycles, we're going to deny you the right to vote in the next one.
Exactly. And so Kemp's office, in order to get around that, says, no, we don't purge. We're just maintaining our voter rolls. And we only remove people from the voter rolls when they haven't had any contact with election officials. But if you haven't moved, then there's no reason for you to contact election officials to do a change of address. If you haven't changed your name, there's no reason for you to have any contact with election officials to do a name change. And so the not having contact with election officials really gets down to you haven't voted. But that's the subterfuge they use. And so Kemp has kicked off more than 1 million people off of the rolls. That can tilt an election.
Carol Anderson, the new book is called One Person, No Vote, How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy. By the way, a listener called to say that there have been African-American governors in the past. That is, of course, true. Doug Wilder in Virginia and Deval Patrick in Massachusetts. But there are currently no black governors in the United States right now. So if Mr. Jealous or Ms. Abrams or Mr. Gillum in Florida wins, there would be black governors for the second time in American history. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. There are some 77 million people in the United States who could vote, who are eligible to vote, but who are not registered to vote. And of course, these regulations regarding what criteria you are allowed to use to purge the voter rolls, the regulations regarding how many polling places should be available to voters in any jurisdiction, the regulations about voting in general, are premised in keeping the voting rolls secure and up-to-date and truthful. And you remind us that from 2000 to 2014, that's a lot of election cycles, there were 31 voter impersonation cases. But of course, there were 1 billion votes cast nationwide. So the proponents of stricter ID laws, stricter restrictions to the number of days of early voting, for example, are saying they want to keep the rolls clean. They want to keep the election. They want to keep maintain electoral integrity. But you're saying that that's a myth. It's a shibboleth, and it's simply not true.
Yes. Yes. It is. I've started thinking about it like the Reichstag fire. And that was during the early years of Nazi Germany. The Reichstag caught on fire. And Adolf Hitler used that. It's not even clear who started the fire, but he blamed his opponents and then used that to consolidate his power. But the fire itself wasn't what he was making it out to be. It's the same thing with the issue of voter fraud. Because voter fraud has been the Republicans' Reichstag fire. It has been the myth that they have blamed on Democrats and people in the cities, which means African Americans in that kind of dog whistle GOP way, that these are the folks who are stealing elections. And so when they talk about we have to have integrity of the ballot box, we must maintain the sanctity of democracy by ensuring that only the people who are supposed to be voting are voting. When you dig down into the evidence, they really can't point to this widespread, rampant voter fraud. Even Trump's Election Integrity Commission, which was founded on his lie that there were millions of people who fraudulently voted and cost him the popular vote. When that report, which a Democratic member of that commission was able to get his hands on, when he saw that report, he published it because it showed that under voter fraud, they didn't have anything. They could not find the evidence of what they say all of this apparatus is about because it doesn't exist. Because when you think about it, it requires someone to don somebody else's identification and do that multiple times with multiple identifications to vote over and over and over and over and over. It doesn't make sense. It simply doesn't make sense. And when they have caught someone, like the Trump voter in Iowa who voted twice because she believed his lie that the system was going to erase his votes from being, they caught her immediately. So this thing about rampant voter fraud is just that. It's a myth. It is a myth designed to then strike fear in the hearts of American citizens that the democracy is in peril. And then to say, but we're going to be reasonable in what we're going to require in order to keep democracy safe. We're merely requiring IDs. But they're not merely requiring IDs. Your library card is not going to cut it. They're requiring certain types of IDs. And places like North Carolina have gone through to figure out what kinds of IDs African Americans have and what kinds of IDs African Americans don't have, and then to make that the Holy Grail.
And you mentioned Wisconsin as well. The number of people in Milwaukee, again, a city, a predominantly African-American city, who were denied the right to vote in this last election. And, of course, Mr. Trump very famously carried the state of Wisconsin. And who knows what would have happened had the voter, the voting system in Wisconsin and in Milwaukee in particular been less restrictive about who could cast a ballot and who couldn't.
Exactly. I mean, so in Wisconsin, there was a 60,000 between 60,000 voter drop from the 2012 election to the 2016 election. So 60,000 fewer people voted in 2016 than they did in 2012. 68% of that drop came out of Milwaukee.
And what's the evidence to suggest that it wasn't caused simply because these folks decided to sit out the election? I mean, some 70 million people did sit out the election. People who were registered, who could have voted across the country, just said, nope, I don't like either of these candidates or any of the candidates, and we're just going to stay home.
Well, you know, there have been studies done, for instance, in Wisconsin. Scholars went in there, political scientists went in there, and they said, okay, what's going on here? Why are we seeing this kind of drop? And people started identifying that they didn't think they had the right ID to vote, or that they didn't have an ID to vote. So the basic issue of IDs was one of the major reasons for the drop. The data are clear on that. And one of the other things that we also know is with the gutting of the Voting Rights Act. One of the things that the states who had been pre-cleared, had previously been under pre-clearance, did was they began to shut down polling stations. What that does is they shut down 868 polling stations by the 2016 election. For every tenth of a mile that a polling station is removed from the black neighborhood, the African-American voter turnout goes down by 0.5%. I mean, so, you know, we talked about Georgia. One of the things, and I think this blew up nationwide, one of the things here in Georgia, shortly before this upcoming election.
Yeah, there was one county they tried to close a whole bunch of them all at once.
Yes, they did. And so you think about it, here in was Randolph County, that is over 60% black. A consultant who happens to be an ally of Brian Kemp recommended that 7 of the 9 polling stations be closed because they weren't ADA compliant. Now, what he didn't recommend was that they make those polling stations ADA compliant, nor did you see this kind of let's shut them down during the general election, during the primary, nor during the GOP runoff between Brian Kemp and Lieutenant Governor Casey Cagle. It's only when we're getting to the general election between Brian Kemp and Stacey Abrams that then this let's shut them down comes through.
And, of course, it seems to be about ADA compliance rather than anything else. All right, more to talk about when we come back with Dr. Carol Anderson. This new book is terrific. It's horrifying, disconcerting, troubling, but it's a beautifully compiled compendium of what's going on in terms of voter suppression. It's called One Person, No Vote, How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy. More with Carol Anderson when we come back. 410-662-8780. The email midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle @MiddayWIPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. And thanks from me as well to everybody who made a pledge in our pledge drive, although it was slightly attenuated because of the doings in the Senate Judiciary Committee yesterday. But we are all very, very, very grateful. I'm Tom Hall. It's midday. And today we're talking about how difficult it is to vote in the United States in a lot of places. So why is voting not structured to be as easy as possible? Why do laws in some states allow the facile purging of voter rolls? Why is it that there are as many as 77 million people who are eligible to vote but who aren't on the voter rolls? Why do we hold elections on Tuesdays when most people have to work? Why can't we expand instead of restrict the number of days available for early voting? Is voter fraud a real problem, or is the specter of fraud simply being used as an excuse to disenfranchise voters, particularly people of color? By the way, early voting in Maryland begins on October 25th. You have until October 16th to register it. And if you are registered, you can vote not only on nominees for office, but also on two referendums. One involves requiring that money from gambling goes directly to education, and the other would allow people to register and vote on Election Day. This would make it easier for many people to register. Right now, you have to be registered by October 16th in order to vote in the early voting on October 25th or the election itself on November 6th. So this referendum says folks would be able to come into a polling place on Election Day, register that day, and then cast a vote that same day. Dr. Carol Anderson is my guest. Her latest book is called One Person, No Vote, How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy. Our phone number at midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWIPR. And so, Carol, I want to talk a little bit more about restricting the number of polling places and the direct correlation between certain political outcomes and efforts to do things like strengthen voter ID laws and restrict polling places. And you talk about in 2008, Barack Obama won the state of Indiana. And that was a surprise. That had been a Republican stronghold for a long time. And so the legislature came up with a pretty simple device. They decided that counties that had at least 325,000 residents, in other words, fairly large, couldn't have more than one early voting site unless all sorts of stuff happened in the local jurisdictions. They particularly were worried about a place called Marion County. So why were they concerned with Marion County? Why does it seem that this legislation was devised to affect in particular that place?
Marion County is the home of Indianapolis. And Indianapolis has about 200,000 of Indiana's African-American population. And between Lake County, where Gary is, and Marion County, Indianapolis, that accounts for 68% of the state's black population. And after that 2008 election, what the Republicans figured out was that it was early voting, particularly coming out of Indianapolis, Marion County, that had been the margin of difference for Barack Obama's victory. And so their response was not, wow, this is great. We've got people voting, and this is what we want in a democracy. Remember Paul Weyrich's thing? I don't want everybody to vote. And so the response is actually, I don't know, Orwellian, Alice in Wonderland, Kafkaesque. The largest counties can only have one, whereas the smaller counties, the suburban counties, counties that have white suburbs, counties that are in rural areas, they can have more than one early voting site. Does that make sense? Of course not. But what happens then is that in Marion County, for instance, with its one early voting site, because you have to have a bipartisan agreement on the election board to get more than one for these counties with over 325,000 people. And Mike Pence, as governor, signed that law.
Carol Anderson, the new book is called One Person, No Vote, How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy. Carol, let's go to the phones. Bowling is on the line from Moncton here in Maryland. Bowling, welcome to Midday with Dr. Carol Anderson.
Hi, how are you guys today?
I'm blessed, but I'm a mess. How about you?
If you give me a quick second to make sure I'm not on speakerphone anymore, I'd really appreciate that. Almost there.
So you have the slowest speakerphone button in all of creation, Mike. Bowling, tell me what's on your mind. All right, why don't we come back to Bowling? He's working out his technology issues. Business of voter IDs, you remind us that there was a legislator in Missouri, a guy named Kit Bond, following this has to do with the Help America Vote Act, the HAVA, back in 2002. He got a quid pro quo, and the quid pro quo involved voter ID. And what was the trade-off? What was the conversation back then when this law went into effect?
And so the trade-off was, because that 2000 election was just a hot mess. I mean, as we looked at what happened in Florida with the hanging chads, the butterfly ballots and all of that, the botched recount, the trade-off was, and he was in St. Louis where he's hollering voter fraud, voter fraud, voter fraud, although what we had was a massive illegal voter roll purge, is that he helped shepherd the Help America Vote Act through. In order to get those kinds of remedial efforts in terms of upgrading voting machines, in terms of having a body, a designated body that voters could go to when their rights had been violated so that they could lodge a complaint, in order to deal with all of these kinds of efforts to see to it that we didn't have 2000 again, he required that in order to deal with what he called rampant voter fraud, that we have voter IDs as well. And so you get the reality of the kind of massive disfranchisement that was happening in St. Louis and in Florida being put on par with the lie of voter fraud, and both of them being embedded in federal law as if they're equal. And so that becomes the basis then, this voter ID in the Help America Vote Act. That becomes the basis for Indiana's law in 2005 that the Supreme Court said was constitutional in 2008, even though Indiana could point to no evidence of voter fraud in any of its history. And that became the basis then for Brett Kavanaugh to rule that South Carolina's voter ID law was fine, because even though South Carolina could point to no evidence of voter impersonation fraud in its history.
Let's try Bowling again. Bowling, I'm a person of great faith, and so I've determined that the gods have major speakerphone problem disappear.
Are all solved.
There you go. Good. Welcome to the show. What's on your mind, sir?
Thank you for the show and for your patience, my friend.
And thank you, ma'am, for writing the book that I have wanted to write. My question for you is, can't we now, in this modern day of technology and cell phones and credit cards and tax paying, can't we get over the necessary, also very difficult thing of registering? Why do we need to register if the banks know where we are, if Uncle Sam's knows where we are, if Verizon knows where we are?
Well, you do need to register to vote. I mean, people need to be on the voting
rolls. I get
rules.
That. But my question is, what is in the 21st century the function of registering to vote? Why do we need that now when there's a million ways to verify if somebody is a real person and not voting twice?
All right, interesting point. So, Carol, I mean, there are people who say that, there should be automatic voter registration, and the only way to not be registered to vote is to opt out of it, to decide, I don't want to be registered to vote.
Right. And so, we've been talking a lot about voter suppression, but there are states that are working on how do we get more of our people registered to vote? How do we increase voter turnout? And so Oregon took the lead, and Oregon instituted automatic voter registration so that the moment anybody had any doings with the Department of Motor Vehicles, they were automatically registered to vote. And they had to say, no, I don't want to be registered in order to get pulled off of the rolls. What that did in Oregon, and Oregon already had one of the highest voter turnout rates in the nation. What that did is, in the next election after automatic voter registration, Oregon's turnout rate increased by 4 percentage points, and the diversity of its electorate increased. California looked at that and said, oh, we want some of that too, and instituted automatic voter registration and went one better and said, we are now pre-registering 16 and 17-year-olds. So that when they turn 18, they're automatically registered to vote. Then you had, I believe it was Illinois, that said, we're going to do you one better. In addition to the Department of Motor Vehicles, because not everybody has any kind of interaction with the Department of Motor Vehicles, we're going to include other agencies where our population may be having contact with, such as the disability office. And from there, then we get another increase in automatic voter registration. So you have these places that are thinking through, how do we get more people registered to vote? How do we increase voter turnout? But most of the voter suppression techniques that we're seeing, the voter ID, the voter roll purges, the shutting down of polling places, we're seeing those in these Republican strongholds where there's a Republican governor and a Republican
legislator. It does seem clearly that is partisan. And, Carol, unfortunately, that is all we have time for, but I can't recommend this book highly enough. I think it's a really, really beautifully put together tome on a very important issue. So we look forward to having you here in Baltimore tomorrow, and safe travels. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm on my way.
Dr. Carol Anderson, her new book is called One Person, No Vote, How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy. You can meet Carol Anderson tomorrow afternoon at the Baltimore Book Festival in the Inner Harbor. She'll talk about it at 2 o'clock at the Literary Salon. And we've got a link to the event at wipr.org/midday. That's it for us today. Coming up Monday, encouraging people to invest in Baltimore. I'll talk to the founders of Baltimore Homecoming. They're inviting folks to come back to town and learn about investment opportunities as well. Mary Miller, she's a former senior official in the Treasury Department. She'll be here. She's going to talk about her work. She's been studying how local banks are investing in the local economy. We want to thank Bottoms Up Bagels for providing lunch today. Bottoms Up Bagels is a small batch pop-up bagel shop preparing hand-rolled New Jersey-style bagels, house-cured lox and specialty cream cheeses inspired by traditions of bagel making dating back to the 1940s. Available at the Waverly and JFX Farmers Markets and online at bottomsupbagels.com. I'd like to thank the Midday team, Luke Spicknall, Rob Sivak, Sienna Grease, Kathleen Cahill, Jamila Krempel, and Austin Coughlin. I want to thank you for listening. Have a great weekend. I'm Tom Hall. Take care.